Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Well, are you ready for a little bit of, what do I want to say, time travel? How about science fiction? Are you a fan of that genre? I know I am. I enjoy so many different aspects of what I want to say creative material. But my guest this evening, a woman that has put together a series of publications, and I have learned that this is what she calls the Old Earth series. And there is 5 volumes to this series, and we're going to be touching a little bit on each one of them. However, it is an incredible read because you have these different spectrums of time and circumstances and personalities, and it goes from a particular environment, from another planet, if you will, and then dealing with what she calls, again, the Old Earth. I want to welcome Anne Fraley to the show. Anne, you've got an imagination that doesn't have any boxes in it. I'll tell you, you just let it go. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Anne, I asked you before we started our conversation, when did you get this concept? Because you have in each one of these volumes, there is so much material. Did you feel like you were born on another planet and came into this world because you decided to tell the story as you see it of life on this planet? I mean, it really is an amazing read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think part of it is, if you know how a good painting works, it's layered. You do a base coat and then you layer on. That's how this book has occurred because, well, the series and the further series in the New Earth world is because it's been over a long period of time. And so if I started this era, I started in 2010, the original concept, and I wrote the first 3 books as just Old Earth, actually the first 5 books as just Old Earth books. But then I was doing some other writing, and I realized after I had my husband was my big encourager, and he passed away. And after he passed away, I was left raising my kids and trying to do everything else. But the writing, it just would not leave me. It was my sanity base to go there and to immerse myself in the Old Earth world, but I realized I needed to get better at it. I needed to do a better job to increase my craft because I wasn't, you know, trained in that field. I was trained in education, but not in the literary craft. So I got a master's in writing for entertainment. And then during that time, I started playing with sci-fi and I thought, oh, this needs to go back and look at those first works, because we're talking the land of Ur, you know, with Aram, and then we're talking about generations following human history. But I thought, they're not alone. We never were alone. And let's bring in the New Earth world, but go back their family generations and add them in, because then you have the arcs of all the characters. Why do we do what we do? Well, because there's a reason. There's a family reason, there's an emotional reason, there's a spiritual and a psychological reason. So it was layered, many, many rewrites to get to that point.
Now, you just mentioned that your background originally was in education, and that was in elementary education. You were a teacher, and then you actually homeschooled all of your children. Yes. How many children do you have?
8.
Excuse me, how many?
8.
How in the world did you ever find time to write? My goodness.
Well, the writing and the children, it was a good combination because actually they all became good writers themselves. They all have done really, really well in college and the higher academics, you know. So I have one that's a chemist and is going into a PhD program, and I can't even begin. It's something to do with genetics, and another who's in a master's program. And so they've all gone on and done well. And I think it's because we discuss things. We talk about stories and books, and they love to read, and we read together. And, you know, I'll read pieces of my work to them, and they'll read pieces of their work to me. So I think there's something intelligent-making when a parent interacts with literature and children and you talk about it and it becomes a part of your culture.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Now, you also, which really intrigued me, you serve as an election judge and also a secretary treasurer of your small town cemetery. I mean, I wonder, do you ever sleep?
Well, I try to be efficient with my time. That's true. I find the spaces in the day, like one of the things I learned early on with raising the kids is that I have a tendency to overdo because I it's not that I get bored, but I want to be busy doing things. I want to be productive. Uh-huh. Now, I must admit that part of that, I've always been interested, and I find other people fascinating. I love to be active. So I've taught my kids to do things for themselves and to study for themselves. I'm not spoon-feeding them. And in order to do that, I had to back off and be doing other things that widened their scope, that said, you know, oh, by the way, we do have a duty to our community, and what can I be doing? And somebody asked me to be the election judge. And it's a broadening of all of our experiences, because when I get involved in one thing, I bring it home and I share with them, and then they learn and they go out and they do things and they bring it home and share it with us. So community involvement actually makes the family tighter and stronger and more involved.
Well, I'll tell you what, your books, with the detail and the way that you have put it all together, is just incredible, because your very first one of the Old Earth series has just a title, Aram Encounter. And Aram is a fascinating personality, but you have a personality, along with others, that are of an other world, and there is one character that I was really fascinated with, and that is Teal. And you go between the two. You go between those that are wanting the human race to survive, and you also then deal with the realities of the human race and the time frame that you are originating with. And it was really, really tough. And so you have this, you have the alien councils, and the Supreme Council is putting Teal on assignment. And some of the characters that he encounters, I just said, oh, this is a good thing to read before you go to bed. Yeah, great. Oh, yuck. I don't think so. Anyway, it is, you know, it's not a horror book at all. But, I mean, the characters, you described them so vividly. And there was one in one of the books, and she was quite an interesting insect. Anyway.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have all of these unique characters, and in a way, it reminds me of some of the characters that were created by the writers of Star Trek, you know, the original Star Trek, all of the different things that evolved even in the following years after that original grouping of programs were canceled, and yet look at the movies and the characterizations and all of the different species that are designed and developed. And it's just so intriguing when you start off with Aram, and then you go to Ishtar, and Ishtar. And again, Teal is having to deal with a lot of situations because there are those that feel that the human race just isn't worth very much. And you have Ishtar here, and you go, oh my goodness, wow. This is, you know, this is another part. And like you said, it's the family tree. Now, because of the phenomenal amount of characterizations that you have, what was it like when you first put back Aram and then Ishtar coming in? I mean, this is, this had to have taken a good deal of time. Did it just sort of flow with you, or did you find that certain characters took on a life of their own?
Yeah, that would be very much. I mean, I started with Aram. Aram was my first character, and I knew him. I don't know how I knew him, but he came to me pretty fleshed out. I knew his heart. He was a good-hearted person, struggling to hold his clan together against, you know, the big cat who was chasing his people, and his sense of that he really wasn't fit for the job, but he wasn't sure that he could keep his people, his clan safe against all of these dark terrors that were hunting him, and against his own insecurity and his wife. He knew that wasn't going well. And, you know, he's a human being. And this sense that there's more to life than just what meeting the eye and what happens after death. These are like a coming to consciousness, which is what Aram is based on. He's based on the question, the original question I had in my mind was, where did Abraham come from in biblical times? Somebody had to start wondering, wait a minute, are these all gods or is there one God? Somebody had to kind of wake up and start self-aware thinking about this stuff. And it wasn't that I was giving the answers or that I'm telling the readers what they should think about God, but rather just the journey story of humanity going, what do I believe? And then dealing with evil. Ishtar was raised by a very evil man. And did he have a chance to become anything but evil? Does our family life and our circumstances define us, or can we be something different? So they're really important questions because, you know, we do come from, some of us, very tragic environments, and you have to decide, am I stuck in this, or do I still have free will? And I think those self-aware questions come through the characters. They lift us out of our little worlds and allow us to ask those questions on a big scope.
And then you have Neb. Oh my goodness. He's the, you know, it's like the Adolf Hitler of that time frame. And just a real interesting individual. And that is, again, it is just what you said. Good, evil, why is it that we have to go through certain things in our lives? Why are we given the opportunity for choices? Do we take advantage of those choices, or do we play the role of a victim? But it is very, very interesting because, again, Teal is featured throughout along with some of the other characters that are with him. And he's often challenged because he really feels that there is a maturation that's occurring with the human race, but it is trying to convince those off planet that that is the case. And then you have Georgios. And Georgios is a fascinating character. What with Georgios, when you were putting him together, this is something where it was almost as if he just, all he wanted to do was to be the best person he possibly could be. And yet there were those from off planet that would go through time and be able to be present here. And there were so many things that they experienced. It reminded me of some of the old stories about the gods of Olympus. and how they would work with human beings or they would not work with human beings. And it was just a fascinating book to read.
Yeah, Georgios was he was innocent, whereas Noman, who's the character that is kind of the telling point of, basically, he's a devil's advocate. I'm going to prove to you. I'm going to show you humanity really isn't worth it. This we could just harvest their planet, but we don't need to worry about humanity. They're not worth it. And he wanted to make that point very clear. And the question was, because Georgios isn't alone. He's got a father who's a Roman, and Romans had done some pretty awful things. And Georgios needed to answer the question also, am I my father's son? And am I able to overcome the worst of my father's sins? So again, and then I think that's the ultimate crux of the question, you know, during that first century is, who are we becoming again? Who are we being, who are we being brought into? And there are the devil's advocates out there who are going to say, you know, look, you're not capable of it. I can show you your sins here. Look. And I'll show you your brokenness. I'll show you your stupidity. And we hear those voices in our own heads sometimes reminding us of mistakes and telling us that we're not worth it. And that perpetual, naysayer that puts us in that dark tunnel that says, no, you can't climb out of this. You're not capable of being anything better. And I think that's what Georgios had to come across. He had to face that and go from innocence, not to arrogance, but to a new adulthood.
Melchior. Now, this is the last in the series. And with Melchior, you place this aspect, because you've done the previous generations, this is taking place in Britain in the 5th century. Now, Britain's history is just loaded with blood and war. I mean, that is something, well, you could say the same thing about Russia and about many different places on the planet. But we've got history that gives us a lot of detail, but Melchior is a man that has a very strong sense of ethics, and he's aware of so many things, and yet so much is out of his control.
Yes, he's educated. He's one of the very few educated people in the environment, and basically he is, as he said, he's living among barbarians. And I mean, this is right after the Romans have pulled out, the Anglo-Saxons are in, and the original Britons are there, you know, and they're trying to find their place. There's all this, everyone's jostling for position. There isn't a one king, there are many kings, little dominions. Mm-hmm. And so he's just trying to survive, hold his family together. And it's not easy because the evil that he's facing is from within, is fury and hurt and hate and all the lies and all the deception and then his own, you know, his own weakness that he wants to hurt back. And where does that take him? So, and will it work out? Will he be given the strength he needs? Will his family be taken care of? Questions we ask ourselves.
And he would have visions. And he would write things, but he couldn't recall this one vision. And he would, this is something where he would just say, I just can't. I know it's there. I understand it. But he literally would go into a time slip. That's what I would call it. And it's as if he accessed information. And then he would have to come back to the very environment that was a constant battle for him. And his family, obviously, was very, very important to him. And he was working on his family tree, like people are working on their genealogy today. And that is what Melchior was doing himself. And then there were some bits and pieces that were missing. But there's so much in this segment that is the very fifth book of the entire series. And for one, to really get the whole picture, if you start with the first book and then you go one right after the other, you see mm-hmm. the relationship and the conflict that this character, Teal, is constantly going through with the Supreme Council, you know, with those that are off-planet that are really just saying, forget about it. This just, oh, my goodness, we just need to move on. And mm-hmm. the intrigues that you have in each of these books is something. But Melchior goes through so much. You have Adele, you have a king that is reigning, and oh boy, he's someone you wouldn't want to have over for dinner. you have Nicholas, you just have all of these fascinating characters. When you were writing this particular book, this is the last in the mm-hmm. series of five on the old Earth. When mm-hmm. you were putting this together, did you find that some of the characters you knew were going to play out, was that revealed to you in some way as you were writing? Or did the characters themselves say, it's time for me to be laid to rest?
Yeah, I think the storyline, once the arc kind of, they've achieved their end, they mission accomplished, you know, every character has something to show us. And when their mission is accomplished, it is done. And so, you know, Aram didn't last through the whole series. Teal does. And Teal is the father of Cerulean, who is the main character, the Luxonian, in Last of Her Kind, the newer, which is the beginning of the newer series. And honestly, I needed to go back because Cerulean was such an important character. He had been a character I've been carrying in my mind for so long. I needed to create Teal to explain Cerulean. So it's funny how it's kind of worked, again, generationally, where I've had to, in order to understand characters I had now, I had to go back to their parents. I had to go back to their origin to understand them. So that's part of what was happening, is that keeping that generational connection between fathers and sons and friends. And that sci-fi arc that you're seeing in the story isn't complete until you get into the New Earth world. Then you see the further generations mm-hmm. and why, which ones will get off the page and new ones will come on.
Mm-hmm. You go into some of the traditions and a lot of the things that occurred during the 5th century. And, of course, this probably would, you know, the series would make a great television series. I mean, I don't know that anybody's approached you with that, but you have something here that goes through cycles of time, each of the books standing on their own merit, but you need to be able to have one so that you know the other. And like you said, it's the family tree. And mm-hmm. to be able to put this all together, have you ever assembled an actual outline of the family tree that goes along with the books?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have all the notes. I have what's called my Old Earth and New Earth Bible, which has all of that. And actually, I did create a feature film when I was doing my master's program for Last of Her Kind. And then I used that, I did theories, but I did it for the New Earth world. I never went back and did the Old Earth world because I wasn't sure. I mean, I just finished Melchior, the rewrite of Melchior, because after I did the New Earth worlds, that's when I knew the characters well enough to go back and rewrite the Old Earth world. So I just finished that one, and I haven't done any script writing for those. But I think if somebody could, and I think it would be, it could be something that if down the road somebody is interested in following up, that would be I think myself, it would be interesting because the characters are very full, and mm-hmm. there's a lot there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are very full. You went the extra mile getting your master's degree so that you could become a better writer, and your education, your patterning is a very rich one. For someone that has a very vivid imagination that says, oh, I would love to be able to write like that, I would love to be able to put this book, that book out, what would you want to say to them? What would you want them to be aware of? Because obviously you have become very, very refined in how you put things together. You're able to keep the plot in place, and it can have many different aspects to it. It's like putting a puzzle together. What piece goes where and fits appropriately? This, all of this, what would you say to someone that would admire your work and say, gee, how can I become even better as a writer?
Well, you're very, very kind. And I sincerely appreciate everything you say about my writing, because you don't always, as a writer, you don't hear that from people. Occasionally, you know, I'll see comments on reviews and things. But I've failed more times than I can count. I've given up more times than I can count. I have said I'm no good, and I've had people say, oh, you know, this isn't a good way to write this. You should do it this way. So I think number one is that you write what you're proud of, what you find fun and interesting to read in your own style, because I've had people try to rearrange my style, and maybe it's been a God's gift that I wasn't, you know, handed to an editor who siphoned, you know, my material into a certain pattern that they thought it should be, but rather because I'm independent, I had to do it myself. I had to learn the editing skills, the computer skills. I had to get beta writers and beta readers and professional editors and professional designers to learn a ton of stuff I didn't plan on learning. But it all made me better at what I do. And I think just being able to let yourself fall down every now and again and go, okay, you know, I don't like this, and then get a rest, and then come back and try it again, and be willing to be patient with yourself, and know that you're going to have a unique voice, and it's not going to be just like somebody else. Uh-huh. It is going to be your own. And if it makes you laugh or it makes you cry, then you're doing your job. You know, you got to be able to please yourself in your work. And if you're doing that, then, you know, you give it out and some people will get it and some people won't. And don't allow the naysayers to take you down.
Boy, I think that that is quite a statement. And I think it's very true. I think too often there are those people that want to pigeonhole someone. And mm-hmm. I know I haven't done novels like you've done. I've done children's books. And what I found mm-hmm. so interesting is when I shared material with children, they got it. Some adults mm-hmm. would say, I don't get it. And I thought, well, it's not for you anyway. So, you know, that is really something. And I felt with every single book of yours, with every one of them, there was an aspect of the educator coming through, asking people who would read to think. Mm. Because when you go through the off the planet world and then the old Earth world in those time frames, that is something most people were not educated at that time at all. Very few people could mm-hmm. read and write.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so communication usually was done, let's say, by pictures. There was some kind of language maybe that people had, but it was not articulated in a written form. And it took a good deal of time to be able to reach that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, even in today's world, I was just reading some material this morning when I was reviewing things for upcoming guests, and there are many people throughout the world that are not literate. And yet we've got more people that can read and write today than I think in a long, long time in history. So, you know, it's fascinating to be aware of the material that you have put in here and that you're bringing together contrasts that will make someone think, as I feel H.G. Wells did, and Jules Verne, and even Beatrix Potter did, you know, with her children's books. There are those that are classics, and it's just been my observation that those authors, Voltaire, those authors wanted people to question, to think, and that is very significant, I feel.
Well, I mean, ultimately, when I'm writing, I'm thinking through things. It's making me think. I'm trying to climb to a mountaintop position so that I can look out and go, because life is confusing. Life is perplexing to the, and it can be painful as it's perplexing. And in the writing process, especially when you write and you try to stay true to a character, you allow that character, you're not telling people, okay, this is what this character is going to do because he's going to teach you a moral now. No, that character stays true to the events and plays out his role. And I go, and I'm thinking to myself as I'm writing this, you know, I'm understanding how things happen, how human minds and hearts and souls and how interactions work. Because the characters, the one thing that I really, really wanted to do was allow the characters to be true to themselves.
Well, I think you've accomplished that. And it is an intriguing read to go between an off-planet environment with a Supreme Council to dealing with the old Earth. And Teal and many of his cohorts are going through that wormhole, if you will, that enables them to go between these two different environments, but there is an agenda that's behind it. It really is. It makes it for a very, very interesting read. And I think, you know, it's something that you just want to curl up with and have your cup of tea and chocolate and, boy, just say, this is it. I'm gone. I'm on, you know, in another world right now, which is what I think the gift of reading often brings to us. Now, you have a website, and you've written a number of books, and your website is A.K. Fraley, F like Frank, R-A-I-L-E-Y. So that's A for Anne, K like King, the middle initial, Fraley, F-R-A-I-L-E-Y.com. And they'll find all kinds of information about your film, about your other books, and it is just a delight having you as a guest, and I know you're going to keep on writing.
Yes, and I do a weekly blog. Every Friday, I either put out a short story, a reflection, sometimes a poem. So every Friday, check it on my blog, and there's something new.
All right. And I'm just delighted we've been able to have this time together. Thank you so much, and may you enjoy continued success.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed meeting you.
It has been my pleasure as well. This is Donna Sebo. We're saying goodbye to Anne Fraley, and we are going to be continuing. I am in studio, and you can call in and chat with me if you so desire at 253-582-5597. We've got some good things to share with you this evening. But again, if you want to chat, I'm available for that too. We'll be right back. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, Programming and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebosClassics.com. This is Donna, and we are going to just keep on moving along. And what I wanted to say is that if you like what you are hearing and you want to be made aware of the upcoming guests, and every once in a while we have a switcheroo, which happened earlier this week, or last week, excuse me, then all you do is like us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and that is going to be the way that my assistant Deb will be able to keep you informed. And every Wednesday, we have that wonderful program, Warriors for Peace, which I really enjoy doing. And we are going to be talking with a wonderful individual, and you're going to find out who that is shortly, because all of that is going to be put into place as of tonight, and that will be on the website and announced tomorrow. So we're still up in the air about the guest that's going to be on Warriors for Peace. So that is upcoming, and we are going to be in place with what we need to do. So all of that will be put into positioning tomorrow. And remember that the Donna Sebo Show is done Monday through Friday, and that's 8 to 9 p.m. Warriors for Peace every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Wednesdays are the doubleheader evening. And then we have guests from all over the world. And when I'm in studio, and of course, I always announce that at the bottom of the hour. And when we're in studio, then we're able to take your calls, and I look forward to that whenever I have a chance to chat with any of you. So just know that that is coming into positioning, and then before we know it, we are going to be in the month of March. But who's coming up for the rest of this week? Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about shamanic creativity with Evelyn Rysdek, and then Bottoms Up with Lisa Boucher, and then Family Immunity Cookbook, Tori Amador. She's in Canada. And then the Chintaman Crystal Matrix. Yes. And the guest that I have on the 28th in England, I'm still trying to find if he is going to be available. So we may have some other situation, or it just might end up being an open mic hour. Sometimes people have some challenges, and in this case, I think the gentleman has been ill. So we will see if we're going to be able to get him for the 28th. And if not, then it probably will end up being an open mic hour. So I'm just wanting to fill you in. 253-582-5597. Well, I hope you had a fabulous weekend. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we're getting a little bit of a cold front. We're going to be down in the 20s. So it's always good to curl up with a good book and snuggle up with your favorite comforter and just enjoy a moment of good reading. But I also had the opportunity over the weekend, because we had some pretty blustery weather, so I sort of hunkered down, and I had a chance to watch a movie that I had never heard about before. It was called Miracle Dogs. That is the best movie, and apparently they came out with a sequel that I haven't seen. But if you want a movie that just makes you feel good, if you're a canine lover, that is a book to watch, Miracle Dogs. It's just absolutely delightful, and it is on YouTube. And after seeing that and going through, and I even called up a friend, I said, oh, you've got to watch this movie. And they said, you know what? I think I saw it quite a while ago. But I said, okay. But they said, nope, I think I'll go back and watch it. You know, so many times we have movies that are out that are very depressing, or you get depressed because of certain circumstances that are going on, or maybe you've watched too much of the news, and you go, I need something to lift my spirit. It's a great movie. And with that, I wanted to share with you a story by the name of Lawrence Cross, and this was his own personal story. And there was a little boy. His name is Jeremy, and he had always wanted to have a puppy. Well, the parents didn't want to give him a puppy because he just wasn't old enough, they felt, to be responsible for that puppy. He got a big surprise, though, on his 11th birthday. His parents brought a huge box, and the box was wiggling, and, of course, they were laughing the whole time. And when he opened it, he kept saying, "I know it's a dog. I know it is a dog. It must be a dog." And out of the box came this adorable Cocker Spaniel. And, oh, Jeremy wasn't aware of how you determine whether it is a boy puppy or a girl puppy. And his parents just had a good laugh at that one. And they said, "Well, it's a little girl." And he said, "Great, I'm going to call her Sandy." Now, this dog and Jeremy, they were a team. They went everywhere together. And one of Jeremy's favorite activities was to ride his bike. And, of course, Sandy would just be running right along with him. He'd always keep an eye on her. And she'd run ahead of him, and they just had a wonderful time. It was sort of like playing catch-up, you know, with each other. And he said it was just great. Jeremy just absolutely had the best time with his best pal, Sandy. And the dog was about a year old. And it was summertime, and they end up going to the beach that was nearby. The family loved to go to the beach. Well, after he had been playing in the water and he comes out, he starts telling his mom, he said, "You know, I just don't feel too good." And he had a stiff neck and he had a bad headache. And the next day, he wasn't even able to get out of bed. Well, they were able to call the doctor and he could hardly move. So the doctor said, "Why don't I come out and I'll take a look at Jeremy?" And he did. And the doctor made the announcement to the family that Jeremy had acquired polio. And apparently at that time, there wasn't a vaccine. So he ended up spending 3 months in the hospital. When he came home, he had a brace on one of his legs and he had to have crutches so that he could walk. Well, Sandy, his best friend, his beloved Cocker Spaniel, would not leave his side. She was right there. Now, Sandy started shortly after he got home. When anybody in the neighborhood would ride by on a bike, she would just bark furiously. Remember, that was part of what they did. That was the game that they played. And she would run out into their yard, and they had a fenced yard. And she'd run back and forth in the yard, and then she'd run into Jeremy. And Jeremy, it was told by his dad, he said, "You know, she wants you to go out and ride your bike." And he said, "I can't. I'm never going to be able to ride a bike again." Now, as it turns out, after a few days, Jeremy went out because Sandy just wouldn't give up. And he goes out to the garage, and he sees his wonderful Schwinn bike, and he said, "Well, that's it." Well, Sandy follows him everywhere. She was as excited as she could be. She just absolutely wanted him to ride that bike so they could start playing the old game that they just loved to do. And he kept telling her, "I can't do it. I can't do it." Sandy would just sit down, and then she'd whine. She'd cry a little bit. She'd whine. And she just couldn't understand why he couldn't get on the bike. Well, every day after he had spent that time in the garage with the bike, she'd run out, run back, run out, constantly begging him to ride the bike. All right, so what happens? Jeremy finally gives in. This had gone on for quite a while, and the parents did not interfere in any way, shape, or form, because they were very much aware that the dog was trying to give their son a real message: ride the bike. So when he first got on the bike, oh, she was so thrilled. He started to ride the bike, immediately fell over. He had the brace, he didn't have the balance, And what'd Sandy do? Yes, you got it. She ran over to him and just started licking him on his face and just running around in circles. She was so thrilled that he had gotten on his bike. Well, with all of her attention, he said, okay, I'll try it again. He started. He fell down again. What did she do? She went over, she licked his face again, and this happened 4 or 5 times. Finally, when he had the last fall, he started laughing. And he looked at his best friend, that beautiful Cocker Spaniel, Sandy, and said to her, okay, Sandy, I am now getting very mad. And Sandy just sat down and looked at him. And by golly, it took Jeremy 3 months before he was able to get the balance so that he could ride his bicycle again. It took another 4 months, and he was not wearing a brace. He had built the muscles up in his legs. He was walking with a cane, and as it turned out, as an adult, he didn't end up having a limp. And Lawrence knew Jeremy and knew his story. And that's why he wanted to share it. He said, Sandy was one of those dogs that you wonder, was she really aware of the challenges that Jeremy was going through and how significant she was and getting him to get up and get going? Well, when I came across this story, I knew I had to share it because, again, when you hear about animals and the impact that they have, it wasn't all that long ago when it was looked down upon. No animals were allowed in a hospital. And there was finally an awareness where people, it didn't make any difference what their age was, when they were sick, when they were recuperating, they didn't feel like they had a chance at anything. When animals were brought into their environment, they saw amazing things happen with people. People were getting well. People were not as depressed. People didn't feel as isolated. And I've known people that have gone in to senior facilities, that they play music. I had a friend who played the harp. I've known other people that have played the piano, did entertainment, did shows, sing, you know, all kinds of things, even dance and perform for them. And there is something so special about animals. And I know more than one individual that takes their dogs, sometimes cats, sometimes bunnies. I've met a person that took in a llama. I'm not kidding you. Do you know the response of people that do that? The response of patients to the animals. And, of course, there's health requirements. You know, you have to make sure that your animals are, you know, vaccinated and that they're very clean. But the thing is that these animals know when a person needs something. And I delight in the stories that I have come across and shared on the air. And one was about a hospital cat. It was a resident cat. And this cat always knew, and this was a senior facility, always knew when a patient was getting ready to die. That cat would let the staff at the hospital know. Because that cat would go into the room, that cat would go from room to room, checking on people, and then would stay in the rooms when they knew that that person was going to transition, and they would stay with the patient. And I've heard so many stories through the years of the way animals have responded and what they've done and the difference it has made to people. I look at prison systems that have incorporated animal training, where inmates are trained to do this. And because of working with the dogs, especially, I know here in the state of Washington, there's the women's prison out in Purdy. And I have a friend that has been out there and been trained with her service dog to work with animals, and what she saw, the effect on the women that were incarcerated was amazing. Well, the same thing has happened with men. And this is something that it makes them a caretaker of something bigger than they are in the sense of purpose and meaning. And it often enables them to develop a better image of themselves. It's really quite amazing. And I just think that animals bring such a special, special gift to us that I feel is invaluable. It is invaluable. So we have just, we've got so much to be grateful for. And I think stories like this, sharing these stories, it is really very, very valuable because we need to remember we are not the only species on this planet that contributes to the well-being of others. Oh, no. There are so many, many different creatures that bring joy into our lives. Well, researchers, and by the way, if you want to give me a call, 253-582-5597, researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we are more familiar with it as being known as MIT, they were doing research on how to quickly seal wounds in critical life-saving situations. Do you know where they found some answers? Well, it's from creatures of the sea, specifically barnacles. Now, if you've ever been a beach person, born in Southern California, believe me, I saw lots of barnacles. They usually were on those huge, huge logs that were put in for the wharfs that were put out into the ocean. Just huge, huge logs, and they were just covered with barnacles. Well, they are amazing creatures, and they will stick on just about anything. Rocks, the hulls of ships, wet, dirty surfaces. They just absolutely love it. Well, apparently, barnacles secrete a sticky protein. And MIT's researchers, that particular team of people, created a biocompatible glue that can adhere to human tissues even when they're covered in blood. It creates a seal within 15 seconds. And they say this is so much faster than the time it takes, several minutes, for sutures or patches with blood clotting features to do the very same thing. So they are hoping that they're going to have this so that it's available for paramedics or even for those of us that always like to have a first aid kit handy. You never know when it's going to be useful. You know, there's also, I remember back on a program called Beyond 2000, there was a medical professional that was in an area of Vietnam. He was in a village, and the enemy often would put stakes in the ground, and these villagers had rice paddies. And they were walking in the rice paddies with very little foot covering. And if they stepped on any of these sticks, it could really damage their feet badly. Well, this particular doctor in that village noticed the people weren't too concerned. And he found out when he had a soldier that was very badly injured and was hemorrhaging quite seriously, they said, oh, we can help you with that. And there was a plant that they used that had particular properties that I think were similar to what happened with the barnacles and that sticky protein. Well, this plant had something of that nature, and it literally would stop the hemorrhaging. And this doctor was able to bring the plant to his lab, wherever that lab was, and he created a synthetic product that resembled what those people in Vietnam had, and he carried that in his first aid kit all the time for any kind of serious, deep wounds to prevent infection. Because the people in the village, they didn't lose their feet. They didn't have gangrene. They didn't have the problems that you would normally say would evolve from being in that tropical environment with all of the various bugs that you have around you and bacteria and fungi and all other kinds of good yummy things. So this and the humidity and the weather and just what that in and of itself, if you're wounded, can create with infection, they didn't have that problem. And that is something I remember. I do not, again, I don't remember what the plant was. I don't even think he mentioned that. But he synthesized what the blood stoppage capacities of that plant, what they were. He was able to stop that. And I think there are so many people around the world that are always saying, how can we do something better? What can we do that's going to improve things, whether it is some mode of transportation, growing food? There's always going to be someone that says, we can do it better. Well, being that we're coming into spring, I will tell you, we want to get out here in the Pacific Northwest. We really like the outdoors. And of course, this is the time of the year when you're wanting to get out, plant things, because you want to put bulbs in the ground, even though the temperature's getting down to the 20s. It'll only be that way for a couple of nights, and then it's warming up again. That's just the way spring is in the Pacific Northwest. So getting outdoors is one of the best things you possibly can do. And if it warms up enough, what we typically do is open all the windows and air out the house because everything's been closed up all through the winter. And that is something that really is what we need to do because it perks you up like nobody's business. And also, we know exercise is important, and it is so very important you do the kind of exercise that you really want to do. So if it's walking and you can team up with some buddies and just be out there, whatever it is that brings you joy, go for it. Also, you keep hearing things about nutrition, nutrition, nutrition. Well, I've always been fascinated with the fact that the Eskimos didn't have the heart problems and they ate diets high in fat. And you have all kinds of things that are recommended, but it's not the same for everybody. We're all different. We're all unique. And among the native Alaskans, they would go with their foods for the season. If they were able to catch a whale or seal or anything like this, they prepared for winters because their winters were long and hard. The fat of the animals was never thrown away, ever, because that gave the body the fuel that it needed during the winter months. Berries were dried and kept for the winter months because then they would make their own kind of ice cream and they would mix it in with snow. And it just was something that was very refreshing. It was also a good way to get their vitamin C. And I recall on one of my trips to Alaska, a woman that was spending time in Alaska. She lived way out in the boonies. In fact, they would go in once a year and buy all of their goods and needs for the entire year. But they ended up suffering from a lack of vitamin C until someone sent them a gift package of preserves where the fruit is right there in along with the essence, which we would call the jam. And she said that gift enabled them to get enough vitamin C to get them through to the summer months. So, you know, those vitamins are important, but when you can get them from food, that's the best way to do it. Donna Sebo here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I look forward to you joining me tomorrow evening. And I will be announcing what's going to be on Warriors for Peace. You will have that tomorrow evening. And then we're going to be talking about shamanic creativity. Take care. God bless. Be well. And just know, you're a light. Turn it on and let it shine.
listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.